Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play dude.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, it's been a minute, but we are back with another toy department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. What have you been doing with your life the last couple of weeks?
Well, I guess my girlfriend was in town since we last spoke, and she is moving out here soon. What else have I been doing with my life? Working, you know, doing some radio.
Yeah, it's playoff time in your business.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an exciting time at the Warrior flagship radio station, you know, cruising towards third title in 4 years. Everybody still finding reasons to complain. We did an hour last night, me and my partner. I mean, he brought it up ridiculously. And then we did about an hour of it because we got that many calls with people who had something to say on, like, literally just nitpicking Steve Kerr.
An hour of nitpicking Steve Kerr.
Pretty much, yes.
I feel like I could do an hour of complaining about Cleveland complaining. and by the way, which is not it's more of a slight that, you know, because the Warriors are plenty guilty of this themselves. Like, but you know, when you see LeBron on this, you know, doing kind of like the what me tirade, and then the PA address announcer is like, foul number one on LeBron James, and it's like 8 minutes left in the fourth quarter, and you're like,
"It's he's just a tough one." But here's the thing, man. I just had a really big thought about LeBron James that I'm not sure I've ever fully crystallized in my brain before. In almost all of these things where LeBron ends up getting criticized, he really is doing everything he can just to win. And a lot of times that means making the right basketball play. And that includes whining and complaining, because it is a proven method of improving your whistle over the history of the NBA.
Yeah, working the refs works. And I think, unfortunately, we figured that out in politics, too. but yeah, it is ultimately it's an effective strategy. But we're going to save the NBA for later on in this podcast.
Yep.
I don't want to get too far down the NBA hole. Instead, let's jump
don't
back
be
into
an NBA hole. Oh, sorry.
Let's jump back into the Kanye hole for a minute, because there's actual Kanye music out in the world right now. Really, two pieces of Kanye music if you count the Pusha T record that he produced.
Yeah. I it's funny you say that. I like the Pusha T album better. And honestly, it's strange to say this about a guy who rarely strays far from the Virginia drug dealing scene in terms of lyrical content. But I would rather hear Pusha rap than Kanye rap at this point.
Yeah,
Kanye has nothing to say. He's either ranting about, you know, YouTube deep state videos, or I'm not generally a big lyrics guy, but from a guy who is making such a scene of himself and purporting to have something to say, I listened to the album once through, and it's the music's good. It's Kanye makes good beats. You know, if you want to say they're like somewhat ghost produced, fine, that's a separate conversation. But Kanye West, the production artist, puts out good beats.
Right. At the very least, he curates good beats, even if he's not making them.
Yeah. Those are here.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But especially with a 7-track album, you'd think you could distill whatever this message you have is to something other than open your eyes, libtard, and I love fucking bitches. Like, it's just not, I don't know. Even if you go back to early Kanye, when he wasn't as skilled of a rapper, he had more to say.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. The 7-song thing is the one thing I like. To me, this is a pioneering innovation, and
okay, but hold on. It's only a pioneering innovation because of, I see the same promise in it that you do, that we have had over the last 5 years. I can think of a number of sprawling 15-track albums that would have been a spectacular 7.
Yeah, right? I mean. I stole this line from Chris Ryan, but
seven.
All albums are 7-song albums at some point, right?
Right.
You know, and
you skip.
Yeah.
You put the 7, if it's a good album, you put the 7 favorite songs on a playlist, right?
Right.
But the problem is these are not a spectacular 7.
Yeah, I'm not arguing that point. I wouldn't know because I'm on Kanye Time Out and I've only listened to one of them. You can tell from pretty much the consensus out there.
Which one was it, and what was it? What do you remember what it was about?
The name of it has escaped me right now. It's the Kid Cudi track.
Okay.
Because I am sort of interested in their upcoming collaboration. That seems to be the most interesting of these things going on. Look, you know me. I am all here for someone who wants to make Drake diss tracks, but yeah. I just not interested in Hampton Roads. Coke slinging tales like that. That's just a sure. Very limited.
I'm a Pusha T fan because I love his voice and I think he's clever and funny. And I think the diss track shows that to some extent. It also shows he's vicious. But yeah, as far as Kanye goes, I'm more interested in hearing him produce for other artists at this point than I am in a Kanye album, I think.
Well, that's why, to me, the 7-track thing is the most interesting thing, and I do wonder if the general lack of success, ultimately, of this Kanye project it will discourage people from making records of that length.
Or maybe it will discourage people from infuriating their audience with nonsense that has nothing to do with music, because I have to say, like,
well, that too,
there are, here's an interesting point. There are, if I may say so myself, there are Kanye albums that I have listened to once and not been sure about or not even liked and gone back to and found more in. This Kanye album, I listened to once, found nothing particularly interesting to me. And in large part because I'm annoyed by Kanye and his like weird alt-right conversion, I'm not going to go back, at least not anytime soon.
Why you got to interfere with his free thought, man?
Well, I don't know. When it's someone like Kanye, like I really am, I do think he is in some ways a brilliant person. And I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but when it just keeps sounding like, you know, a Twitter account called Richard Spencer fan, like I don't know what to do with it, and it literally just seems like Kanye went on a bunch of YouTube deep dives into, like, you know, a bunch of Alex Jones type stuff.
Is it really that?
Doesn't it seem like that?
I mean, look, I know he said some dumb stuff. Is that what the record? I'm asking you because I haven't heard it. Is that what, like, the lyrics of this of these 7 songs are, most of them along those lines of owning the libs?
No, I'm just saying, like, his general attitude about, like, open your eyes, sheeple. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily libtards. That was probably the right. I should have said sheeple instead. But that does seem to be his attitude, that, like, free thinking to him means what it means to Alex Jones. Free thinking means conspiracy thinking.
Yeah, I don't know.
And I'm not saying he's diving deep into that stuff on the songs. In fact, I'm kind of exactly saying the opposite. Yeah. Like, I'm saying there, it's mostly I love sex sprinkled with open your eyes, everybody, to the real stuff that's happening here.
To
I'm
all the sex.
I'm just trying to think free.
I wish we could just open our eyes to all the sex. You know, and then the Celebrity Family Feud appearances that are upcoming. I don't know. I'm over Kanye. I'm just over it. Like, you know, I've stopped giving him the benefit of the doubt that he's a genius. I follow him on Twitter, so I just seen him say enough dumb stuff. You know, dumb stuff coming out of his mouth constantly, and I don't know that he's innovating in the space the way that he once was, and that's okay because that's what happens, right? Like, you know, late registration and graduation, like those are 18 years ago, you know. Like, it's sort of the natural arc to lose it at some point, and that's kind of where he is, and I'm okay with that, you know, just ready to move on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
Speaking of moving on, as we jump into television, because there's a bunch of great shows that closed out freshman seasons, in the case of one, its entire run this week, and I thought maybe we could get into some of those. Should we start with Killing Eve?
Yes, because I wish we had been able to drop a mini on this last week, but schedules did not permit. I just love this show so much. And I don't know how quickly we want to spoil it.
Well, let's just throw out the spoiler. If you... you haven't seen it, you might want to skip ahead. I think we just ought to do that. It's going to happen sooner or later.
All right. So spoiler alert, because I feel like I have to talk about the end to talk about the entirety of the season. Obviously, the question is, what is season two of Killing? What does season two of Killing Eve look like? And that question, to some degree, for me, hung over the whole episode. Not in a bad way, really, but in a, well, what on earth, how do you resolve this in a way that pushes into season two with what I believe to be two of your most important assets, which are Jodie Comer and Sandra Oh, both intact and available?
Yeah, I mean, it's not all that dissimilar from the issues facing the Barry finale. You know, there's obviously some parallels in the show and even a common actor or two.
That's
know,
right.
Like,
yeah,
so,
and so here are some things I wrote down. In the middle of the episode, I wrote down, did they push Villanelle too far into evil to have her be redeemed in any way? And if so, was that a mistake? Because, like, obviously, if you 1,000-foot view the entirety of the season, one of the most charming things is the relationship between Villanelle and Eve, between Jodie Comer and Sandra Oh.
What
and
of?
So, you mean I should have said the?
Yeah, it's the most interesting thing.
Yes, it's the thing.
Yeah.
Yes. But I just mean in terms of, like, you know, hit rate. And, yeah, it is both the center of the show and the most charming thing about it. And so a natural idea is, like, buddy comedy, right?
Right.
I mean, buddy psychopath dramedy, but you see my point.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we get with the ending, here's what I wrote down near the ending, was like, it never occurred to me. In fact, maybe the better option would be to send Eve the other direction to evil to meet up with Villanelle, more or less. Eve totally loses it, ends up on the wrong side of the law. And you know, could that have been what was happening all along? The show, after all, is called Killing Eve. Maybe that's about killing who Eve was and resurrecting her as a crazy assassin.
Yeah. Do you think that's what season two was going to be, though?
I don't. I don't, but it's certainly an open door, is it not?
I would be more excited about, if that's what season two is going to be, I would be more excited about the show than I show's prospects, I should say, than I am. I'm less excited about this show than you are in general, but I like it a lot. My worry is that we're headed to Orphan Black territory, where it's going to be a much broader focus on the Illuminati-like international syndicate, in this case known as the 12.
And it can get too complicated and just sort of spin out of control.
And meaningless and out of control. Out of control is a good word for it. And that, I still sort of, if I was going to make a bet, I kind of think that's where we may be headed. I feel like the show lost some steam in the last few episodes of this season. Lost a little bit of focus, I think, on the relationship. Certainly Eve's obsessiveness, I think, sort of like took this weird, a little bit of a weird backseat, you know what I mean, to some of the espionage games and double crosses and stuff. And it was a less interesting show, I think, when that happened.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, I don't feel like you ever really got away from her obsessiveness, did you?
I mean, a little bit. By the end, a lot of her, determination to crack the case was just making that dude, look up stuff for her on Google. Not Google, but you know what I mean.
I suppose so. I mean, yes, she had a guy who did the legwork. I suppose she essentially, in a way, we're watching her transition from desk agent to field agent, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that reflects a less obsessive character. She's become completely obsessed with this assassin to the extent that, and mysteriously obsessed. Like, I both want to stab you and then save your life obsessed.
Yeah, like her stabbing Villanelle and me. Yeah, I really like you. that's the show we're here for, right? You know?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And so that's why I say, is season two okay? So what could season two be? Season two could be based on the fact that Villanelle sort of is on the run, bleeding, and Eve is in questionable legal position, having just stabbed her. We could have a Eve running from Villanelle running from, or Villanelle running from Eve, who's running from MI6.
But would you really buy Villanelle running from Eve? Like, I understand that Eve sort of got the jump on her.
Running from exactly, but like Eve chasing Villanelle.
Yeah, but it seems like if Villanelle wanted to end Eve's run on Earth, it probably would not be that hard for her, given what we've seen through the first part of the season.
So I don't think we can go there, right?
No, I don't.
Villanelle has to embrace the fact that Eve stabbed her in the stomach.
Right. Villanelle has to be so emotionally attached as to be unable to use her incredible amount of deadly skills upon her.
Correct. So I'm not even considering that as a possibility. That's why I'm saying, Villanelle coming to grips with Eve stabbing her while Eve tracks her down as an independent person versus Eve going back to MI6 in some way and us essentially having the same show only with that broader angle that you described of Eve trying to figure out who the 12 are.
Yeah.
But in a way, given how far she's gone at this point, and the things she's done, and there is the scene where Eve is like, "I lost everything," and I don't know that she really did, right? But the fact that she thinks that or says that, in my mind, it did feel like at least a half heel turn for Eve in a way, and I think that's the show I'd prefer to watch in season two, is something where Eve and Villanelle are closer to aligned, even if it's a bizarre and difficult relationship, versus something closer to a repeat of what we saw.
Yeah, I would agree. I hope that they find find their way through the story, because the execution part of the show has been very high for a lot of the season. There's obviously, look, like I said, I like it a little less than you do, I think, but there's still a lot to like. And the show's doing very well from a business standpoint, from what I understand. The word of mouth has been huge, and the ratings have really actually been going up at a time when that doesn't really happen anymore. So there's going to be a lot more of this show. So let's hope that it remains. Let's hope that it's not Homeland, I guess is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, I that seems to be a common sentiment about it. I would add that I do wonder if the plan at the beginning was for one of those women not to survive the season, most likely Villanelle, given that Sandra Oh is the bigger name. But Jodie Comer was too good. Like, you can't kill. So I think they're caught in an interesting position where, whether it was their plan or not, they have this story that one of these characters probably should have died plot-wise, I feel like. But they're both so key to the charm of the show that that's not a realistic possibility.
Yeah. I'm gonna ask you to clear out here for a second. Because I think maybe now this is a good time to talk about the finale of The Americans, which
I'll
I know.
I'll put my mic on mute and time it. How long you want?
I don't know. I don't know if I need like a time limit. I'm just saying. I know you didn't watch it, so I'm gonna guess you don't have a lot of thoughts on it.
I got no thoughts.
Yeah, and you didn't care for the show, so I'm gonna double down on you not having thoughts on it. So, I do think right now, though, is the time to bring it up, because when you think about it, and you can contribute to this part of the discussion, I do think that, you know, there is some real common ground in terms of things covered, you know, in these two shows. You have a beautiful, charismatic Russian assassin in both of them.
I don't know. I don't think Matthew Reese is that cute.
You have depth. Well, he stopped being a Russian assassin by the end of it. Sorry, spoiler alert.
Oh, spoiler!
That's not really like a hardcore spoiler, because that's not a recent development that all happened last season. Okay. But you have this charismatic Russian assassin. You have in-depth portraits of law enforcement and the people trying to hide them. You know, lots of war games, lots of detailed espionage stuff. But they're clearly very, very different shows. And whereas Eve, the murder in Eve is graphic and yet also sort of jaunty. You know what I mean? There's a real sort of like flair sure. and joie de vivre in the murder in killing Eve. Americans was a show that was almost had equally violent and brutal murders at times, but was sort of obsessed with consequences and damage, or the setting up of said killings and the real cost and toll of it. Which made it a heavier show, I think, for a lot of people. And obviously it was a show that was, whereas Eve was about fun, a lot of The Americans is sort of delayed gratification. But the finale of The Americans, this is a show, I think, that understood the end game literally from season one, at least. To hear the creators tell it, they knew sort of this is how things were going to end up.
And this was what, seven?
And I believe this is the sixth season was the,
okay.
Yeah. And they had two seasons, they got The Americans was a show that was sort of constantly on the, are they going to keep doing this? And they got that sort of two season pickup at the end. So they had 2 years to really know, exactly the runway they would need to wrap it up. And the result of that was a finale that I thought stuck the landing in a way that very few finales have. There were certain scenes that you knew had to happen, I would say, I mean, how many episodes did you watch of this show before you kind of gave up?
Maybe like the first four.
Okay, so you watched four episodes, but I would say even you, if you were like guessing the end game of the show, would say there probably has to be some sort of ultimately a confrontation between Elizabeth and Philip and Stan, their FBI neighbor.
Right.
So you get that. And I would say also the, you know, and maybe I'll ask you, is there anything else that you'd say you'd figure would sort of have to be handled in terms of this show and the ultimate outcome?
I mean, I imagine one of them, if they ended up on opposite sides, one of them dies.
They don't really end up on opposite sides. I just said Philip quit being an assassin. He didn't turn against, well, I don't want to get too deep into that, but no, they're still on the same side. The thing that sort of gets resolved is the children, right? And, you know,
are they American or are they Russian?
Or are they part of this family or not? You know what I mean? Do they know, mm-hmm. do they know, what their parents have done? For Paige, that question gets answered, much earlier on in the season. For Henry, it's, in this episode. And those scenes are handled so well.
Those kids are how old now?
Henry's 17. He's like a senior in high school. Paige is in college. Okay. So she's in, I think in her 20s, early 20s. Mm-hmm. So, by the end of this, there's this, the confrontation scene with, Stan and Philip and Elizabeth and Paige, takes place in the garage, and is about 10 minutes, and it is so taut and well written and acted, and everything that's great about this show. It really was a joy to behold. There's a scene on the train, that sort of deals with the question of, you know, the resolution of this family, scored to With or Without You. And, you know, The Americans is a show, and maybe you got a sense of this in four episodes or not, that made use of its 80s setting and the music about as well as a show possibly could. There are really a couple great, like, all-time great music montages there in the show. And then the way that they use With or Without You in that final scene was just spellbound. It was just really, really great television. I didn't love season 5 of The Americans, but season 6, I just thought was really fantastic. Up there with some of the best seasons of the show. I know you gave up, and I don't know. I doubt I can convince you to come back, but I would really, really encourage you to come back.
Look, man, someday I may watch that show. Well, I'll put it in. But I'll tell you what, it's behind The West Wing in my queue of shows people keep telling me I should watch.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, The West Wing is from an episode standpoint is a massive undertaking, and I'm not going to discourage you from watching it because I do love that show. And
I'm going to make a weird analog. Have you been watching The Handmaid's Tale?
Now, The Handmaid's Tale, the shows that I'm sort of just like, I don't have the stomach to keep going.
Yeah.
That list is piling up. I think Westworld is – I haven't officially declared Westworld on that list, but for all practical purposes, it is. Mm-hmm. Handmaid's Tale is on that list. I just don't see myself going back.
I got to say, like, slight spoiler.
I put Walking Dead on that pile finally.
Yeah, I still have to finish the season finale of Walking Dead. Slight spoiler for Handmaid's Tale, because the season starts with her escaping, and I was so ready for that. She doesn't last. She is unescaped relatively quickly, and I just don't know that almost every scene of the show now, with the exception of the ones that take place in Canada with is it Samira Wiley?
Yeah.
Elizabeth Moss's husband. Everything else is so damn miserable. It's just, I'm like, I get it, man. I get it. Please, I get it. stop this. Like, get let's see something new. I understand what this world is and how awful it is and all of that. I get it all. Please stop.
Much respect to Ann Dowd, who I think is a fine actress. I just don't want to watch her do this anymore. You know,
no.
We already did this in Leftovers. That was, you know, I got enough of that. So.
And same with Elizabeth Moss. She's fantastic. Joseph Fiennes is great. The woman whose name I can't remember that plays the wife is excellent. The acting's excellent. The plot and subject matter is so miserable. And also more than just miserable, it's the second season of this nonsense now. So, I mean, I just don't need it. I'm not learning anything. I'm just watching these people act misery, and I don't. It's painful to watch.
Yeah. Well, and look, I think maybe that's part of why.
Man, I'm not saying The Americans is quite that. I'm just saying it's. For me, it felt like, and it may be as much about the way it's shot, like it's dark and dramatic in a sad way, and I wasn't ready to undertake that.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a melancholy show that's a lot about what it means to be family, you know, what it means to be in a marriage, while at the same time against this backdrop of people who are, you know, doing horrible things in the service of something that they really believe in. I totally get that. And I would say the difference is we're talking about all these shows where we couldn't make it to the finish line. And what I'm saying is, at least for me, there's something really celebratory in getting to the finish line and really feeling like, wow, I really enjoyed a moment at the end of this. You know,
yeah, I get it. But six seasons is a lot for that feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose. Look, I'm not saying that it's like, hey, you know, this last episode is so good, you watch 120 episodes or whatever it is of television. I don't know what it is. It's less than that. It's probably 50. You know that that's all worth it. There are plenty of great moments along the way. And plenty of really interesting things that happen and occasionally funny things, definitely real moments of humanity along the way. But yeah, what I'm saying is at least, you know, that it pays off in some way. And we don't necessarily know that's coming for a lot of other shows. And I'm finding those shows are just falling on the pile for me. I just, you know, there's too much TV. To make myself feel bad all the time.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying about starting a six-season show that is melancholy. That's precisely my point.
I'm not against sad, and I would say that, you know, certainly compared to, say, Handmaid's Tale, The Americans is not unrelenting.
No, I know that. That's why I said
grim.
It was a weird analogy, but yeah. I think you understand what I'm saying just in terms of the vein of show that it is and how it feels like an awful lot to me at this point, but I understand that it's probably pretty good.
It does. It feels like work, and I would also say at this point, I think we can all agree, like, wow, story in the past that has contemporary meaning is like, okay. I've seen that too. You know what I mean? I don't know that I need more allegories about how the world's currently messed up. I get that notion as well. I just think the Americans is really, really expertly constructed. And this is a show that belongs in the conversation with some of the great shows of the last 15 years. And because, you know, look, not a lot of people watch this show, you know, and I don't know what the streaming life of it will be. But I would encourage people to seek it out and check it out at some point. I mean, look, it's on Amazon, I think now.
Yeah.
You can get it, but I don't know that it's, you know, that people have really taken the time. It's also not a show that, you know, it's tough to jump in season three on The Americans. So, you know, I'm telling you, I'm saying it's worth taking on.
Yeah. Okay. I respect your recommendation.
All right. So the last show that wrapped up that I know we wanted to get to was Trust. I think the nature of this story was going to be that it was a show that sort of peaked, you know, like some old seasons of Breaking Bad did, where it was really peaking around, you know, two episodes to go, and then you sort of have to come down. I think that's just sort of the arc of Paul Getty's life. You know what I mean? And this show had a little bit of that, but I really, really enjoyed this season of television.
Yeah. It was exceedingly watchable for a show that, you know, I just did a whole thing about not wanting to watch melancholy shows, and this is obviously a very melancholy subject matter to some degree, but it's not really a melancholy show.
No, it's kind of a fun hang.
Yeah. Even the dark stuff is kind of lively and invigorating, and man, some fantastic performances. I thought Hilary Swank was awesome.
Yeah.
I thought Donald Sutherland was awesome. Brendan Fraser was really good. The kid was excellent. And I also really loved the Italian actors, who I thought were incredibly well cast and did a great job, especially Primo and the Salvatore, the sort of Don.
Yeah, I thought even the Italian kid, I thought was pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. So everything about this show was really well done, and it's funny, you know. Did you see All the Money in the World?
I've not seen All the Money in the World, and now I feel like it seems like it would just be really unnecessary to do.
That was what I was going to say. Is I also did not see it. But of course, for people who don't know, that's a movie about the same subject where Kevin Spacey was replaced in post by Christopher Plummer. And look, man, I don't understand how this story could be adequately or interestingly told in an hour and a half, and I'm not really here for it. It's like if it was some sort of competition, for me, trust is canon, you know?
Yeah. Did you do any reading, you know, about the real events of this?
Not really, no. I thought about it.
I mean, I didn't do a deep Google or anything. I kind of just went to Paul Getty's Wikipedia page because I wanted to know just sort of the real story of the end of his life or whatever. And Trust, I think, was so much more interesting and emotional than, you know, reading a basic fact summary about his life. I read his and I read J. Paul Getty's.
J. Paul being the grandson or the son?
I think they're both J. Paul Getty, I think.
I think they're all, yeah.
I read The Kid and the Millionaire. I read about both of their lives in total. Okay. Billionaire, I guess you should say. Millionaires, yeah. Selling them way short. And, you know, they're certainly interesting lives. Like, the way the show laid the story out and the emotions and how many just really interesting supporting characters there were, and what it was like to sort of be in this crazy orbit, and the way that it warped people, you know, the negotiations and for you to have this understanding of why Paul's father would be so unwilling to save his son's life because of what it meant for his relationship with his father, which
right.
seems, in fact, borderline insane. The show, I thought, was artful in at least constructing a narrative so that you understood. You didn't necessarily agree with his decision, but you understood where it was coming from, at the very least.
Oh, yeah, no, you certainly don't agree with it, but you're absolutely right. That if anything proves how well executed this show was, it's that you feel the weight on him. I mean, if you told someone off the street, let me tell you a story about a dad who has millions and millions of dollars, but won't spend five of them to save his son's life. Someone's like, that's horrifying and disgusting, and there's no way you could convince me that's in any way reasonable. So the fact that they've painted these characters in a way that you do at least understand, to use the old Chris Rock, I'm not saying it's okay, but I understand.
Right.
It's a testament to how good the show is.
Yeah.
And to those performances. Again, even the middle J. Paul Getty, it's a great performance. It feels like a 10-hour Danny Boyle movie.
Yeah. And I can't say enough about Danny Boyle's direction. You know, it's so much of what made it fun. The show is lively, it moves, it's colorful.
It's
gets
crazy
all
to
of
say this
settings.
In one way, but I think there are times when you're like, oh, this is definitely the guy who directed Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah. And also also where you're like, oh, this is definitely the guy that directed Trainspotting. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah. 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 Which is incredible for a show about what it's about. I mean, it's excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. I really love Trust. I don't know if there's more of this coming. I would assume that if it is, it's clearly not about, you know, it'll be a fully new story.
Right.
But if it is, and if Danny Boyle's involved, I'm on board, you know.
You want to do the Lindbergh?
Do you get the sense? Because I feel like
famous
you and
kidnappings for $1,000.
I feel like you and I love this show. I don't really know too many other people who have even heard of it.
It's interesting. It's gotten a lot less buzz than you'd expect. I mean, it's on FX, which is a buzzy TV station. It's got all these tremendous famous actors in it. I don't know. I don't know what the deal is.
Yeah, it's a little weird in that way. But you know, if you get a chance, if it comes to Netflix or wherever, I guess FX. I think maybe they have a deal with Amazon. That's what it seems like. Wherever
seems
it lands.
Like, yeah.
Watch it.
High recommend, and it's you know, especially in today's day and age, especially given our last conversation, isn't it great to just have a hot 10-episode run and you're out? You know, there's something nice about that.
Something to be said for that. Speaking of hot 10-episode runs, I don't know for a fact that Succession is designed for that, but it kind of seems like it might be.
Oh man, give me like a. 5-second temperature on Succession.
A 5-second temperature on Succession.
Yeah, like what's your how you feeling?
You know, if it's a stock, I'm buying, but I'm not throwing my fortune at it. You know what I mean? Like this first episode was very pilot-y to me. You know what I mean? Like. A lot of we're establishing this person is this person, and here's who they are. And
it's so funny you're saying it this way.
Everyone is kind of really sort of telegraphing, and the know the goofy nephew is really goofy, and the Don Jr. type son is really Don Jr.ing, and you know, like there's sort of a lot of that. But it does seem like it's going to be a good show as it starts to get rolling. Like the elements for that are really in place. So I'm a buy, but I wasn't crazy about episode one, if that makes sense.
I am I am everything you just said, except I'm reading it in a throw my fortune at it kind of a way.
Okay.
You're right. This is a totally pilot-y episode, and it's transparent. It's transparently pilot-y. It's like, here's one scene for this guy, and here's one scene for this guy, and here's a scene for this guy. Like, here's meet the goofy nephew, meet Kieran Culkin, meet Cameron from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. They are all these. Here is the character that is the daughter. You understand who she is. However, I am so here for every one of the characters they introduce. Not one time did they stick a character in front of my face and say, meet this guy. And I went, nah. Every time I was like, yes, let me meet this guy or this woman or this character. And from Brian Cox down to the goofy nephew, I think this show has the potential to be electric. I had a feeling of like, this is the HBO that made HBO HBO is this type of show. Because I was expecting sort of Billions 2.
Well, I was going to ask you if the existence of Billions, and I mean, it sort of sounds like you're giving me your answer, makes you more or less excited about this show.
Philosophically, it made me less excited. But this is not, I don't think it's anything like Billions, as it turns out. This is just a family drama, right? I mean, yeah, you're right. There's kind of a Don Jr. character, and I'm sure we'll get out into the world a little bit. But the setting of this entire show is family internal. And to me, I mean, again, not to compare it to The Sopranos, which is one of the great shows of all time, but like, sure, there's gangster stuff, but that show is a show about a man like learning to cope with life in the 21st century, essentially, and his family. And this feels to me like a show about the interplay between a family and what it means to have that play out in public and have all this stuff on the line, but ultimately a show about a family. And I'm so excited for all these actors and characters. Kieran Culkin, who I think has always been quite good, is rarely so loud.
Yeah, no, he is chewing scenery.
And getting to see, and I think he's spectacular. He explodes off the screen, and yeah. I love seeing him get to go that big and chew scenery in that way. I'm so here for that. Brian Cox, again, we know how good an actor this guy is, but like, in as much as it might have felt a little ham-fisted the way they introduce, all right, here's the media mogul, introduce you to Brian Cox. It is very pilot-y. At the same time, I'm like, yes, I know who this guy is. I see what Brian Cox is doing here, and I'm ready to watch it for a whole season.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope we get more from Alan Ruck than Yeast, though.
So he's the Ferris Bueller's Day Off guy, yeah?
Yeah, Keith Cameron.
Yes. Again, everyone they introduced me to, I was like, this is perfect.
My sense, at least from the HBO promo scenes that I've seen, is that the daughter's going to have a lot bigger role than we've seen to this point.
That makes sense.
Which I think is interesting.
And I wonder how much the grandkids will be involved. Like, there are questions to be answered, but all they really set up is this is a high money family. Everything they do is high leverage and important and high stakes. And there's this family drama. And clearly there are a lot of complex relationships within the family, between the kids with their father. And now we don't know. I don't know. I guess slight spoiler for the end of the pilot episode, but we don't know if Brian Cox is in the series moving forward or just in flashback now.
I'm pretty sure he's in the series moving forward, but we'll see.
Maybe, but he might not be. He it's might possible. Not be mentally, you know.
Yeah.
There.
It's definitely possible.
So I am all in on Succession. I think this is the best thing I've seen on HBO in a while.
All right. Better than Barry, you think, in your mind, or at least potentially better than Barry.
I think the ceiling is a lot higher than Barry. Yeah.
All right. I don't know that I would disagree with or agree with that. I'm in. I definitely think I'm more. The existence of Billions messes this show up a little bit for me, and I'm not. I agree with you that they're different shows, but Billions is so good and already playing in some of this world that you know what I mean. Like, I'm not saying it's carbon copy. I guess
it depends how it moves forward.
Yeah.
If half this show moving forward is in the boardroom, then you're right. But I feel like 20% of the show's, you know, 15 or 20% of the show is going to be in the boardroom, and it's mostly going to be in the family's house.
Yeah. And we can spend some more time on this later because we got to get moving.
Yes.
But I'm curious, are you watching I'm Dying Up Here?
I am.
Are you I'm really feeling like that show is finding its voice in season two, and it's become a greater priority for me, and I was curious if you felt the same.
I don't know that it's become a greater priority per se, but I'm certainly liking it. I think it's You know, the thing it still suffers from is it's like sort of two or three different shows happening at once. Its plot lines end up feeling very separate, but they're all good. So I think I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, look, there's a lot of people and there's going to be a lot of people in a lot of different
sort of
places.
The nature of an ensemble show to this degree. But if you're watching this season, just to do 2 minutes on it, there's sort of the Adam Proto and, for lack of a more tasteful way of putting it, the sort of Black storyline.
Although Adam, you could also argue it's really an Adam, Ron, and Eddie storyline too. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's a second one. No, yeah. But I'm saying Adam and I forget the character's name, but Eric Griffin's character and the whole record deal and all that, like him trying to get his career going. It's a story about race politics in America at the late 70s. And then there's the story about Goldie and Ron Martin, Brad Garrett's character. Yeah.
Brad Garrett's been a great addition, I think.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
And then there's the sort of Ari Grainer and the dude with the long hair. I wish I had prepared better for this.
Yeah, that guy's a million things. We're already taking too much time, but to me, that love triangle story, which can be tiresome, is really working.
I agree. No, it's doing good. The show's doing well, and there's some great comic relief stuff with Andy Daly and Al Madrigal.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's also and every once in a while it just pops into something funny. So
Yeah. No, it's a well done show.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm glad to hear you say that. All right, let's jump into sports because we got to go pretty soon, and we may not have a chance to talk about the NBA finals again.
So, bye-bye. It's over.
I'm going to take the other side of that. I mean, look, there's no question that one team appears to be better than the other, and it's the team.
No, but I mean, you realize game five will be before we talk again.
Yeah. No, but I'm fairly confident that Cleveland's going to win game three.
Uh-huh.
So we know that there will be at least a game five.
We don't know. Fairly confident feels a little strong to me, but I think that's certainly a reasonable thing to predict, and I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. But I would be surprised at this point if it goes longer than five games.
Well, here's the thing. The one thing we can say about Cleveland is that they are not going to be a team down 3-1 that's like, well, we got to fold it up.
No, you're right.
So the playoff cliche of it's not a series until somebody loses at home still applies.
Uh-huh.
And no one's lost at home yet.
Fair enough.
I agree that one team looks better than the other. no doubt. But I think we can also say that LeBron is playing as well as he has ever played. And clearly game one, he was good enough that just him being that good was good enough to win a game. The Warriors have a gear that Cleveland does not possess. And when they play at that gear, Cleveland doesn't really have a chance. But I don't know that they're going to find that gear in Cleveland at all. So,
okay.
You know, if I had to guess, they come out of there 3-1, but it wouldn't shock me if it was 2-2 at the end of this.
I'd be pretty surprised. I just don't think the Cavs have enough, man. I mean, look, Andre Iguodala is likely to return, and if he's anything close to healthy, it's just a pretty insurmountable talent gap.
Yeah, it's a big talent gap.
LeBron's better than Anthony Davis, right? But talent-wise, the Pelicans, outside of that point, the Pelicans and Cavs are not that dissimilar from a level of talent perspective. And that's just tough, even with LeBron. It's just tough.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true if Love is not fully healthy, which it seems he's not.
Well, Drew Holiday's really good. Is Kevin Love better than Drew Holiday?
I still think he is.
I don't.
Even though I'm not sure Cleveland has utilized him. 100%
of part of the problem. They don't use him right. That's part of the problem. But either way, Drew Holiday's really good, man.
No. I'm not trying to throw shade at Drew Holiday. I agree.
Well, and frankly, Nikolai Mirotic is better than anyone else on the Cavs, right?
Yeah. I think those crappy Cavs guys are just different guys at home. And I think that Cleveland, as we talked about with, you know, the refs working, like they're going to get 47 calls in these next couple of games. And that stuff's going to matter. So,
yeah. Yeah. And look, there's a, you know, injuries can always happen. Anything can happen, but it looks awful tough for Cleveland.
You know what? I just can't. Like, I mean, look, I'm a Warriors fan. I want them to win, and I'm looking forward to them winning. But what I'm not looking forward to is people going, oh, LeBron lost another one.
Yeah.
like the
it's dumb.
The artistry of what that man is doing right now.
Well, no, it's the people who that's the same crowd as good thing Peyton got that extra Super Bowl to catch up to Eli. It's like, no. That has nothing to do with it. Yeah. LeBron's one of the two, maybe three greatest players of all time. If you want to be, if you really want to diss him, you could call him the third greatest player of all time.
Yeah.
But
which I think is becoming a stretch.
It is. It's a real stretch, and to nitpick his championship losses by taking them out of context from a talent perspective. I mean, of all these series, I really only think there's one that you can point to, finals series, and say that's a bit of a demerit.
The Dallas one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They should have beat Dallas. Yeah. They were the better team. But Dirk was on a mission, and Dallas wasn't trash. You know? It's not that easy to win an NBA title.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's been in the finals for 8 straight years on 2 different teams is ridiculous.
Yeah, and then he's like playing every minute.
Yeah. You know? I mean, like, 3 different teams, really, if you think about how different this one is.
Yeah, and then he's dropping 29-13 on like a not great night, you know?
Yeah.
Like in the finals. It's
in that game, I heard Nick Wright give this statistic, and man, that guy's fascinating, but that's a story for another time. But check this out. I'm pretty sure I remember it correctly. LeBron, with his whatever it was, 30 and 13 assists, created 60 points by scoring or assisting in that finals loss. That has happened 13 times during his career in an NBA finals, someone being responsible for 60 plus points. So in the 15 years LeBron has been playing, 13 times someone has had a finals performance where they created 60 or more points. 12 of them are LeBron.
Yeah.
One of them is Steph Curry.
It's pretty wild. It's pretty wild. And you look at the game that he had in game one where, you know, he scored 50.
And arguably should have won.
Right. They should have won. And when you think about like how many assists he could have had where he threw to open guys that just bricked it, you know, in that game, it's pretty wild.
Yeah,
it's pretty wild.
No, you look at his passing numbers, and then you look at the 3-point percentages of guys like Kevin Love and J.R. Smith, and it's just all those misses are just assists LeBron should have had on wide open threes. Like that's literally what it is.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, but this mountain is too tall to climb, I think.
It's pretty tough. there's no doubt about it. And then, you know, you start – we can do this next week. But when you start looking at this run now, this 4-year run of the Warriors, you know, you're starting to see some things that there isn't a ton of historical precedent for. I'm not going to say none because there's definitely some, but it's pretty rare.
Well, and it's really next year is a fascinating one because the Warriors roster is going to change pretty significantly and they're going to have the best competition they've had in their entire run in all likelihood.
Well, and the league is going to change, I think, pretty significantly too. So it's, you know,
a lot
that remains to be seen there. All right, mm-hmm. Before we go, World Cup is coming pretty soon and I'm curious what your level of excitement is.
My level of excitement is, it's curious to me that all of the World Cup coverage people are trying to sell me Mexico, given that they're allegedly my chief rival at all other times. And I don't understand why that is the angle, rather than just selling the greatest players in the world, none of whom are on the Mexican team.
I mean,
no
offense. Look, I can give you that. That to me as that's a programmer basically looking at the numbers. You know what I mean?
So they're selling to a Latin audience.
It's not just a Latin audience. I mean, look, there's a lot of it is a Latin audience, but the most popular national team in the United States is Mexico, just in terms of viewership.
That's
what it's about. By the way, the more people watch Liga Mexico games in the United States than Premier League games. And Champions League games.
Well, that's got to be Mexican people, right?
It's a fair amount, but it's not, and Americans of Mexican descent, but it's not just Spanish speaking people. It is a little bit weird, you know, because if you are a person that really follows the USMNT, you hate Mexico.
Right. That's
but
what
you know
I'm
what?
Saying.
I will watch their matches in the World Cup. Like, I'm interested, you know, I'm not rooting for Mexico, but I'm interested in what they do, you know. I'll probably be rooting against them a lot, but
yeah,
I'm still going to watch, you know.
Well, look,
I know they're players, you know,
I can, because this happens every 4 years and it's the best soccer. Well, it's certainly an incredibly high level of soccer, and the level of talent is the most you'll see gathered in one place at one time for the most part. So, yeah, I'm fired up.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think there are, you know, when you kind of you throw all of these storylines in, and I think there are some interesting things. And I think it's, you know, the idea that you're going to have both Messi and Ronaldo in this tournament kind of with undermanned teams, and they're really going to both be trying to pull like LeBron's at the same time. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be fascinating. You know, I think, you know, teams like England and France that really want it and tend to underperform, I think are going to be fascinating. Germany is the favorite. But the Germans tend not to do well in World Cups after they've won one. So, you know, that'll be interesting. Brazil, I think, is going to be formidable. A lot of people like Belgium as sort of the up and coming team. You know,
still Fellaini the guy there.
You've got Eden Hazard and Kevin De Bruyne from Manchester City.
Okay.
There's a lot of talent on that team. Lukaku's on that team. They're going to be good. Brazil's going to be good. Brazil's always good.
Dutch? I always like to root for the Dutch.
The Dutch are not in the World Cup, so
that's a bummer.
So you don't have to root for them. It's a weird one. There's no U.S., there's no Italy, there's no Netherlands, there's no Chile, who has a ton of talent as well. The Argentina side is not what they used to be. It's going to be a real interesting, I think, semi wide open.
When is game one?
I believe next week.
All right.
So, I'm fascinated, and I'm also just very curious to see what the ratings are like here in the United States without the U.S. Soccer has grown a lot, I think, since the last World Cup, and certainly since since maybe two World Cups ago. People are used to watching high-level international soccer. They're used to it being a part of the, you know, daily sports diet, seeing it on SportsCenter, and on the crawl and tickers. To me, I think soccer has already passed hockey. It's gonna get baseball at some point. Probably.
Oh, I agree.
You know, probably within the next 10, 12 years. So it's an interesting time for the game in the United States. And I'm curious to see, you know, what the reaction to this World Cup is going to be. Because so much of it, you know, in past years here where you feel like, wow, this is becoming a mainstream thing, was centered around people rooting for the U.S. And, you know, we don't have that this time around. It's so wild that we didn't make this tournament.
It really is embarrassing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like it's the sports equivalent of Trump being elected president. It's like I can't explain it. There's no defense for it. and I'm just embarrassed.
Yeah, and I'm still just sort of coming to grips with the reality of it, right?
Yeah, and the deepest irony is that we have the greatest player in American history on the team.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
Oh, stop. He's clearly the greatest player in American history.
Like, you know, you're not...
Christian Pulisic right now is better than any non-goalie we've ever had.
He's the most talented player in American history, I think.
Okay, let me ask you this. You're building a soccer team, and you have the option between peak Landon Donovan and Pulisic right now. You're telling me you're taking Donovan? Get out. Get out.
I think you are. I do think you are slightly underrating peak Landon Donovan.
I don't think I am.
Like, peak Landon Donovan came over to the Premier League in the middle of the season and like dramatically changed the fortunes of an Everton club. Like, peak Landon Donovan was really good.
He was never a game changer in the same way that Pulisic can be.
I mean, that's literally he was literally a game changer for Everton for a couple of seasons. Look, I'm not saying that it's no slight on Bundesliga Jesus. I'm all in a Bundesliga Jesus, and certainly no one has done the kinds of things playing for like a Champions League side that Pulisic is doing now at 19 or whatever he's 18. Like, it's amazing. So, and he's certainly their best player right now. And if he's not the best player ever in the U.S., he's second, you know. So like, no shame.
So it's a real damn shame that he's missing out on what should have been his first World Cup.
Yeah, 100%.
A real damn shame.
There's a fair amount of young talent to be excited about in the U.S. I think we'll be okay.
Fine, but it's still a bummer.
But it's insane that we're not here, particularly when you look at our qualifying group. So,
all right, what do we got for next week?
All right, so for next week, that's a great question. I feel like we've been saving some stuff. We're going to talk about that that Netflix documentary,
Evil Genius.
Evil Genius. You've finished this already, right? I'm about halfway through.
Yes, I finished it. Well, also, I think maybe give a little recap for Dear White People.
Yeah. Because I finished that. I don't know if you're done with
that. I am nearing the end. Nearing the end.
I don't know. Should we talk about Lost in Space? I feel like a lot of people have been telling me I should watch that.
I watched maybe 20 minutes of it and stopped for reasons that were not necessarily it was terrible.
Okay.
So maybe. Let's discuss that. We'll come up with something else.
All right. By the way, World Cup June 14th.
14th, today's the 5th, so all right, we got 9 days.
We got some time.
All right.
All right, let's get out of here.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed, the light's out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.